Today we're thinking about what the church is in its very essence, and next week we'll look at the purpose of the church, or even if there is a purpose for the church. And friends, these are fundamental questions for us, given that as a church we continue to meet here week by week. And after looking at what the church is, and then what the church is for, on the following three Sundays we'll be looking at the leadership in the local church, specifically at what the role of elder is and what qualifications to look for in someone who'd be an elder. And friends, that's important for us because on the 22nd and 29th of March, we'll have elders' elections. So friends, at this stage in our development as a church, these are all really critical questions for us to consider. And so I'd really like to encourage you to try as best you can to be here each week as we consider these things. Well, now for today's topic, the church, what it is. What is the church? What is the church in its very nature? Friends, it seems to me that very often people misunderstand or underestimate the church. So some in our culture think of church typically as an old Gothic building, which is empty most of the time, but gets a tad busier on Sundays. Or as a quaint sandstone building in which you might get married one day. Others think of the church as a place where narrow-minded, self-righteous people meet. And a church planter that I know, in the lead-up to the plant, said to someone that he was being sent by such and such a church to do the plant. To which this person replied, "Oh, that's my church. The sending church is my church." But, you see, my friend had been attending that sending church for years, and he'd never seen that person at church. Somehow this person thought that she was part of the church, regardless of never being at church. And friends, Christians also often underestimate and misunderstand the church. A few years ago, I was talking to a Christian bloke, and he was talking with me about his brother. I said, "Is your brother involved in a church?" And he replied, "Well, no, but he's up at 5 a.m. every morning having his quiet time with the Lord." So here was an apparently seriously devout Christian man, but he wasn't part of a local church. And friends, others think of church as somewhere where I go to catch up with my friends or my extended family, but where I tolerate or perhaps am even indifferent to those who are not my close friends and not my family. So friends, there's a lot of misunderstanding and underestimation of the church going around. But friends, biblically speaking, what is the church? Well, today I hope to show us that the church is God's extraordinary reversal of what's wrong with humanity, and each local church should reflect this. The church is God's extraordinary reversal of what's wrong with humanity, and this local church should reflect this. Well, friends, Steve Messer, who's known to many of us, once wrote a song called The Prodigal's Lullaby, and it goes like this. "In this world of nightmare madness, it seems everyone agrees, there must be something better than this perpetual unease. So many homesick hearts for Eden, so many bothered by the weeds that choke out truth and beauty, but so few look inside for seeds." And friends, I think Steve's song is profoundly right. You see, humanity was made by God, for God, to live with God in his presence. And the Catechism sums this up. The chief end of man, the chief end of humanity, is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Friends, we were made for God. We were made for Eden, but humanity was thrown out of Eden. Though made for friendship with God, humanity rebelled. So friends, humanity is at war with God and excluded from Eden. But not only are we at war with God, we're also at war amongst ourselves. From hot wars between nations or even within nations, down to cold wars between individuals, in families and in workplaces. Friends, the core reason for all the strife in the world is that fundamentally there's strife between humanity and God. At a fundamental level, we're estranged from our Creator, so we're estranged from each other. As we're estranged from our Creator, we're also, at the very same time, estranged from each other. Friends, it can be put like this. When God judges, he scatters. When God judges, he scatters. So in judging Adam and Eve in Genesis 3, God sent them away out of the garden. He scattered them from his presence, but he also scattered them from each other. They who'd become one flesh would now experience tension in their relationship. And when humanity is sent from the Eden, it's not long before humanity is at each other's throats. So Cain murders Abel, barely blinking an eye in Genesis 4. Or think about the disaster of the Tower of Babel. Humanity had aspired to be God and conspired against God by building a tower to the heavens to make a name for themselves. So in judging that arrogance, God scatters them. He confuses their language so they can no longer communicate with each other, and they're driven apart, they're scattered. But friends, just as God scatters people when he judges them, mercifully he gathers them when he rescues. And the great Old Testament example of this was when God met with his people at Mount Sinai in Exodus 19. After saving them from bondage in Egypt, he gathered them together and gathered them to himself. In saving them, he gathered them, and he addressed them with his word. Friends, at Sinai, God was clearly present. The thunder, the smoke, the fire, the trembling mountain all signify God's presence. But the people didn't see him. Rather, they heard his word through Moses. Friends, that gathering of God's rescued people at Sinai was an extraordinary occasion, a pivotal day, so much so that it became a famous day in Israel's collective memory. Later on in Israel's history, it's simply called the Day of the Assembly. Moses refers to it as the Day of the Assembly in Deuteronomy 9, verse 10. Moses writes, And the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone written with the finger of God, and on them were all the words that the Lord had spoken with you on the mountain out of the midst of the fire on the Day of the Assembly. The Day of the Assembly. We read about it in Deuteronomy 10 verse 4 and 18 verse 16. Now, friends, the Greek version of the Old Testament, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, translates that very word that's used for the assembly at Sinai. It translates that word in the Greek word ekklesia. And friends, what's critical to understand about that is that that Greek word ekklesia is the very same word that's routinely used in the New Testament for church. Friends, ecclesia means the assembly. Ecclesia is translated as church. Friends, church then of very necessity is the assembly. Friends, in the New Testament, the church is fundamentally the assembly, the gathered, rescued people of God, gathered together, gathered to him. So friends, straight away we know that the church has nothing to do with buildings and stained glass windows. Friends, when God saves, he gathers, and when he judges, he scatters. So what happens even after Sinai, when the Old Testament people of God rebel absolutely against him, when they trash the covenant God made with them at Sinai? Well, when that happens, God judges, and in judging, he again scatters. So he scatters the northern tribes of Israel through the arm of the Assyrians in 722. He scatters them and they never return. He scatters the southern tribes through the Babylonians in 586 BC. When he judges, God scatters. But when God saves or rescues, he gathers. And in fact, when God's people were scattered in exile in Babylon, God's prophets foretold that he'd again rescue them, that he'd again regather them to himself back in Jerusalem, that they would return from exile back to him, that they'd be gathered out of exile in a sort of new exodus. And in fact, that happened, at least in part. Some of God's people did return from Babylonian exile. They returned in dribs and drabs between about 538 and 458 BC. But they were a ragtag group. They were small in number, and the Jerusalem to which they returned, to which they were regathered, was actually a rubbish dump. So, friends, there was a sense in which God's people, hoping to return from exile in a new exodus, as foretold by the prophets, that they actually, at the end of the Old Testament, that exodus, that return, never truly happened. That they never truly arrived. When Moses had led their forebears out of Egypt, there was a great climactic day of assembly at Sinai, a gathering before God and with each other. But the return from Babylon to Jerusalem never, ever matched that great day of assembly. God had judged his people in their scattering, but at the end of the Old Testament, they're still waiting for a great rescue, a great gathering, another great day of assembly. When the Old Testament closes, Israel's still waiting for that great assembly, that full return from exile, that new exodus. And then 450 years or so later, Jesus arrives. And in the very first chapter of the New Testament, in Matthew 1, there's a long genealogy ending up at Jesus. Matthew says in chapter 1, verse 17, that there were 14 generations from Abraham to David, and 14 from David to the exile in Babylon, and 14 from the exile to Jesus. And friends, that's very significant. It's a strong hint that Jesus is the true end of the exile, that Jesus has arrived in order to complete the return from exile, that through Jesus, God will finally and completely regather his people in rescue after they've been scattered so long in judgment, that Jesus would gather his people to him. And indeed, immediately, Jesus starts gathering people. So we see that in Matthew 4, verse 19. Come, follow me, he tells Peter and Andrew. And he gathers other disciples. And later on, Jesus says in Matthew 16, verse 18, I will build my church. And again, friends, the word there is ecclesia, assembly, gathering. The very same word that Moses used in Deuteronomy to describe the day of assembly at Sinai. So, friends, Jesus is saying that he's the one through whom people would be gathered and assembled to God. And ultimately, Jesus would do this through giving his life as a ransom for us and for our sins. And in fact, in Luke 9, verse 31, on the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus speaks with Moses and Elijah of his upcoming death and resurrection as his departure, or literally, his exodus. Jesus is the one through whom the new exodus will come for God's people, for all who trust in him. That God would save his people from their sins through Jesus' death on the cross, and in saving them, they'd be gathered to him, added to his ecclesia, his assembly, his glorious church. So friends, after Jesus ascends back to heaven, from where he sends his spirit, what happens? Well, in Acts 2, we start to see extraordinary evidence of the reversal of God's judgment. We see evidence of God's great salvation. So think again about Babel, that great sign of God's judgment, where God linguistically and literally scattered the people. They couldn't gather as one group, nor cooperate as one group, because they were no longer able to understand each other. In judging humanity, God had scattered humanity. But at Pentecost, God starts to undo that. By his Spirit, he grants the apostles the ability to speak in other languages so that their hearers from every different nation and language group, from all different language groups, nonetheless could understand. So Peter preached to them, and all were able to understand him. Peter preached about the saving death and resurrection of Jesus, and 3,000 people believed God's word and were saved. When God judges, he scatters, but when he saves, he gathers. He builds his ecclesia, his assembly, his church. And that's exactly what this gathered group of believers are later called in Acts 5 verse 11. They're called the ecclesia, the church. Now, in the great day of assembly in Exodus 19, God's rescue people were gathered to him at Mount Sinai to hear his word. His church, his ecclesia, had been gathered to God by his word in order to hear his word. But friends, what about in the New Testament? How is God's people assembled? And where are they assembled? The New Testament church is God's assembly, God's ecclesia gathered to him. But where are we gathered? We're obviously not gathered at Mount Sinai, and we're not obviously gathered at Mount Worth. And whereas God's Old Testament people were found in one nation, in ethnic Israel, God's church today is not confined to national or ethnic boundaries. Yet, friends, the New Testament tells us that God's New Testament people are gathered in manner very similar to the assembly at Sinai. Hebrews 12 tells us that all God's people, in a profound sense, are gathered to him and gathered together spiritually, though not yet physically. Hebrews 12 pictures New Testament believers as being gathered metaphorically, not at a physical mountain at Sinai, but at a spiritual one, a heavenly Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem. Friends, through faith in Jesus, we're part of that great assembly of Jesus, that ecclesia, that heavenly church of Jesus. We've been saved and rescued by Jesus through the gospel word about Jesus, and we've been therefore assembled and gathered before Jesus. As Christian people, we were once estranged from God and from each other. We had effectively been scattered, but now through Jesus, we've been gathered back to God. And now we're members of his great assembly, his church. We may not physically be with Jesus in the heavenly Jerusalem right now, but by faith we're there in a profound and true and spiritual sense. In fact, it's so true that Paul in Ephesians 2 verse 6 can describe believers as already being seated with Jesus in the heavenly places, though physically still here on earth. And Ephesians 3 verse 10 tells us that this great gathering, this assembly, this ecclesia, the church, is the means by which God demonstrates his multifaceted wisdom to all the spiritual powers in the whole universe. This wisdom of God, according to Ephesians, is that in and through the Lord Jesus, very diverse people, Jews and Gentiles, who were once at war with each other and with God, and now united with each other. So united, in fact, that they've become one body. That in Jesus, people who were once under God's judgment and scattered from him and from each other and now gathered to God and to each other. Friends, that's a profound demonstration of God's great wisdom. Friends, that's something the United Nations can never achieve. Well, friends, we've seen that when God judges, he scatters, and when he saves, he gathers. We've seen that supremely, all those whom he's saved, he's now gathered to himself spiritually around Jesus through his word about Jesus. Friends, if the basic problem with humanity is that we're estranged from God and therefore from each other, then, friends, the church really is God's extraordinary reversal of that problem. Because the church is God's rescued people gathered to him and so gathered to each other. Well, friends, in the New Testament, the word ecclesia, normally translated church, is used 109 times to refer to groups of Christians. And the predominant usage is in speaking of a church in a particular locality, Christians from a particular locality all gathered together, or gathered within that locality in a number of smaller house churches. And sometimes ecclesia is used in a wider sense to speak of Christians in a broader area. So in Acts 9:31, we read of the church spread throughout a large region, Judea and Galilee and Samaria. And sometimes ecclesia is used to speak of the heavenly church, of which each house church and each local church and the church dispersed more broadly is a part. And each local church is seen as an outpost of the heavenly church, as an earthly expression of that great heavenly church joyfully gathered around Jesus. Now, friends, in the Nicene Creed, which Christians often recite in church, Christians confess that God's church is one, holy, Catholic, and apostolic. And this is an ancient church, an ancient creed of the church. So God's church is one, not at an organisational and visible level, but at a deeper level. The oneness or the unity of the church is a spiritual unity, a unity between redeemed, born-again people throughout various visible churches and throughout history. And the church is holy because God is holy. The holy God has declared his gathered people to be holy, set apart for him through Jesus, to belong to him for his purposes. And God's people, his holy church, are actually called to be holy. As individuals and as local churches, we're to pursue actual, moral, ethical holiness. And the church is apostolic. It's apostolic because it holds to the apostles' teaching, which, as we've seen in recent weeks in the book of Acts, is Jesus' teaching. And the church is Catholic. Now, friends, the word Catholic is much older than what we would refer to as the Roman Catholic Church. The word Catholic, or universal, was used in the very early centuries to distinguish genuine Christianity from heretical sects. Friends, Catholic simply means according to the whole. So to be Catholic meant to believe what the whole church in every place had always believed. To not become heretical by adding to what the whole church had always believed, by not adding to the apostles' teaching. And friends, each local church is an outpost of the great heavenly church, that heavenly church which is gathered to God through Jesus and through God's gospel about Jesus. So that's why at the Reformation, the reformers did more than pay lip service to the idea of the church being one, holy, Catholic, and apostolic. The reformers also insisted that to be truly apostolic, a church must rightly teach the apostles' teaching. That true churches were those that taught God's gospel word about Jesus. True churches held to the right preaching of God's written word, the Bible, and to the right administration of God's visible words, the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper. Friends, the church is nothing less than God's extraordinary reversal of everything that's wrong with humanity. The church is God's assembly, God's gathered people who were once scattered, estranged from God and from each other, but who've marvellously been gathered to him and to each other for all time, gathered around his son Jesus through the gospel. Friends, our world very often ignores the church, as if nothing of significance is happening in the church. In fact, as if nothing of significance is happening here this morning. Or the world ridicules the church, or sometimes treats the church with barely concealed hostility. And as we've seen just this last week, very vividly, the world sometimes even persecutes the church. But friends, given what we've considered today, the church is not irrelevant. No, the church is exactly, friends, what our world needs. And friends, each local church and this local church is meant to represent the heavenly church. So when we meet together, we're to remember that we're gathered fundamentally as people who've been reconciled to God through Jesus, and therefore we've been reconciled to one another. Friends, we're to love one another and proactively pursue peace with one another. Friends, we're to welcome one another. We're never to be indifferent to one another. And as Hebrews 10:25 exhorts us, we're not to neglect to meet with one another. Friends, we should be at church as often as we can for the very purpose of doing spiritual good for one another. And friends, in doing these things, no doubt imperfectly, but in doing these things together as a local church, we will, by God's grace, be very different from the world. And friends, God willing, as a church, we'll be attractive to the watching world, even to this part of the watching world. And friends, by grace, we'll demonstrate that God's church is indeed his extraordinary reversal of everything that's wrong with humanity. And friends, people will be drawn to us, and more profoundly and more glorious, people might be joined to God through his glorious Son, Jesus.